brief history of the universe from the dawn of time up until the creation of planet Earth. Okay, and we've got 40 minutes, so get ready. If you're familiar with the Just So stories, Rudyard Kipling very nicely tells us like how the leopard got his spots, how the elephant got its trunk. Today's story is how the universe got its planets and all the other stuff along the way. So without further ado, let's get started. This diagram, we're going to see all the way through this talk, and this diagram helps us to get oriented on the timeline. You'll see in the far left, I want to say the beginning, we've got time zero, and on the very other side, we've got time 14 billion years later. A billion is 1,000 million, and just to kind of look at this ruler, okay, it's like our cosmic ruler, every small interval on that cosmic ruler is 200 million years. Okay, so we're going to like keep referring back to this timeline to get ourselves oriented about where we are in the history of the universe. And I've made some little icons, okay, to help us out as well. You can see time zero, okay, that's the time of the Big Bang, okay, bang. And right on the far side, about 13.7 billion years, you can see that's today, and also the human race, and a bit before that, dinosaurs. And about 4.6 billion years before that, the creation of the Earth and the Sun. And Father Thomas asked me to talk about everything up until the creation of Earth. And then I believe that somebody else is going to give a talk after that. Yes, he's nodding. This is good. Okay, so this morning we're going to fill in that red blank in the middle, okay, from time zero forward to the creation of the Sun and the Earth. Right, so as we look at the universe around us, you know, we can see this picture shows us lots of kind of points of light. Most of the points of light on this picture are galaxies. Okay, each galaxy contains about 200, you know, million stars or something. So they're big kind of thick collections of stars. And we, everywhere we look in the sky, we see these like collections of galaxies. And the kind of questions that we have are, how did the galaxies come to be? How did the matter get like spread out across the universe the way it gets spread out? And how did all the stuff that goes into the galaxies come into existence as well? And a bit closer to home, this is a nice photograph from the Apollo 8 mission, from the moon, looking back at Earth, and we can see, great, we've got our planet, and our planet, you know, it's our home, and we want to know, where did all the stuff in our planet come from? Like, how did it come to be in the universe? How did it get here? So the kinds of questions we need to ask are, what is the Earth made of? And we had a good chemistry lesson yesterday, so we're kind of all up on our chemistry. And just for kind of, you know, here's a few pie charts about what is in the Earth's crust. And you can see that in the Earth's crust, it's mainly oxygen and some silicon. And we can see that in humans, it's mainly oxygen and some carbon. That's because there's lots of, like, you know, carbon in our bodies, but also water, H2O from yesterday, which is where all the oxygen comes from. So we want to know, where did all these chemicals, all these kind of elements come from that make up our planet and that ultimately going to make up us? So let's look even closer to home. This is a very nice apple tree. This apple tree happens to be in Trinity College, Cambridge, in England. And I know that philosophers like apple trees. Well, physicists like apple trees as well. And this physicist sat very close to this apple tree. This is Isaac Newton. And he started asking kind of interesting questions about the universe that we also ask today. One of those questions being, so, why do apples fall to the ground? Pretty basic question. And it turns out that if you want to explain why apples fall to the ground, you need to invoke this like whole theory about gravity. And gravity is one of the fundamental forces of nature in the universe. So gravity tells us how apples fall to the ground, why planets stay in orbit, why the moon stays in orbit, why tides work, why galaxies stick together. Now, that is one of the four forces. The other three forces are, now I'm going to point them, but you can see the electromagnetic force. So anything to do with charged particles, electrons and protons, how electrons stick together, how electrons and protons interact, how chemistry works, that's all described by this force called the electromagnetic force. You can see on the right-hand side, there are two other forces, there's a weak force and a strong force. These are to do with what we call nuclear forces. So you can imagine that in the nucleus of an atom, we've got all these kind of little positive charges called protons, and we know that opposites attract and like things repel. So how do all these positive protons stick together? Well, you need this other force called the strong force to keep them all stuck together. And using these four forces, we can explain all the kind of like physical stuff in the universe. Now, important distinction. Okay, so this slide is divided into two halves. You can see that on one half we've got a single force, we've got the gravitational force, and on the other side we've got the other three forces. The gravitational force, we say, is a force of geometry. Okay, so gravity works by matter curving space-time. Right? And you can think of this, you know, it's kind of like a grid there showing the sun like bending space-time to bend how light travels. And on the other side, we've got the other three forces, and they are all what we call quantum field theories. Right? Now, this is like a big distinction. It's like the distinction between like analog clocks and digital clocks. And like digital stuff can all go together and analog stuff can all go together, but we don't know how to like mix together analog and digital. Okay, so we don't know how to unify these three quantum theories with this geometric theory on the other side. And that's one of like the holy grails in physics. If you look on the right, you can see underneath the quantum field theory, okay, I've got this little picture with two people in a boat throwing a ball between the two boats. That's because quantum theory, okay, quantum just means like small particle, small countable particle. So it basically means that forces work by exchanging particles. Like if I throw something at you like a baseball and you catch it, you might kind of like stagger backwards a little bit as you catch it. And like we've exchanged a force carrying particle. And that's more or less, okay, how quantum field theory works. And we have these funny kind of squiggly diagrams with straight lines and the wiggly bits in the middle. And the straight lines show the two particles that are like interacting, like the two people in the boat. And the squiggly line shows the particle that's moving between them. In this case, the ball that's being thrown by the two people in the boat. So why am I saying all this? Okay, because if you want to know how the universe sticks together, how the universe works, how planets stick together, how chemistry works, how water works, why it is that we don't fall through the floor, even though the floor is mainly air, you need to understand these four fundamental forces. So going back to, this is how things stick together, why do apples fall to the ground? Okay, the next question would be, what are apple trees made of? Right, so if you like zoom in on an apple tree and we see all these like molecules and things and this kind of chemistry stuff, we see, you know, carbon, hydrogen, oxygen. And if we keep zooming in a bit more, like we really zoom into an apple, then if you remember high school chemistry, we've got a good enough diagram here of a carbon atom. You can see inside the carbon atom, the red and blue dots, they're protons and neutrons. And then in orbitals around it, you've got these electrons. Now, yes, you could have a quantum view of the atom that's a bit different, but the kind of essentials are the same. That you've got positive stuff in the middle, negative stuff around the edges, and they're small particles. But what happens if you zoom in on the protons? Okay, turns out you can zoom in on the protons in the center of the nucleus of the atom, and inside the protons there are other particles, okay, called quarks. And we think that quarks are some of the, like, the smallest fundamental building blocks of, you know, the particle kind of world that we live in. If you zoom in on electrons, we have no idea. Okay, at the minute, we think that electrons are a fundamental particle, which means that you can't cut them up into anything smaller. So these like particles, okay, the quarks, which are like inside the protons and the electrons and things, and a lot of other particles, these are what we call like the fundamental particles and the standard model of physics, of particle physics. So in terms of physics, we describe the whole entire universe, more or less, in terms of these kind of particles. The purple ones are the quarks. They're the ones that are inside the protons and neutrons. Some of the green ones, you can see like the electrons you recognize from the atom. On the right, in the red, you can see things like Z bosons and W bosons, photons, gluons. Photons you recognize from light, that's what's coming out of the light bulbs here. And photons are also the things that in the last diagram, they were exchanging particles. You know, they're kind of passing photons to cause a force to happen. And the kind of famous particle, which is the Higgs boson, is also up there. That's one about giving particles mass. So this is like the physical picture of like kind of what's in the universe. So when a physicist looks at the sky and they see galaxies, or an apple tree and then they look at the apples, what they're kind of like imagining underneath all that are these kind of particles and these four forces interacting with these kind of particles. That is like our basic kind of like picture or worldview of the universe. How did this all come to be? Like, where did it all come from? How did like the forces and the particles get arranged into apple trees, into galaxies, and that kind of stuff? Well, this is where our kind of story begins. So back to our timeline. So we want to know, like, how do we get to today from way back 13.7 billion years ago in the time of the Big Bang? And we're going to zoom in on this kind of very far beginning part of the graph, and we're going to keep zooming in. Okay, now we're down to like 1 billion years, and we're going to keep zooming in. And now this scale has changed to seconds. Okay, so we've got 0 to 1 second. So we're zooming in to like the first second of the beginning of the universe, when space and time were created. So, or began, or whatever you like to call it. Time zero, that's when time began, that's when space began. And there's no such thing as like before time, okay, because you can't really kind of like go with time didn't exist, you can't say what's before time. So time begins, right, time zero, and for the first fraction of a second, which is like 10 to the, you know, with to the minus 43, okay, so like a 0.00000043 zeros, that very short space of time, we call it the Planck time, and in that time, all known laws of physics break down, and we have no clue what happened in that first fraction of a second after the beginning of space and time. So all of physics begins after that fraction of a second. Okay, there are no physical theories that deal with what happens in that Planck time. So that happens, and then a fraction of a second after that, the universe very suddenly gets very big very quick, because it starts off very, very tiny and small, like smaller than the smallest atom, and then it very rapidly is going to expand in a fraction of a second to become huge. And that is called inflation, and that happens at time, you know, 0.000 with 36 zeros after it. Inflation is a great theory to explain why the universe looks the same in all directions. And we haven't really got time to go into inflation too much now. But if you're interested in things like causality, right, you know, if that part of the universe looks the same as that part of the universe, it means they somehow have to be able to communicate. And inflation is a theory that allows you to talk about how the universe was close enough together that the different parts of the universe knew what they had to look like 13.7 billion years later. And that all happened in like less than a blink of an eye, right at the beginning of the universe. And here is a nice picture that we saw a version of yesterday. And this again is showing the universe expanding through time. And you can see that it's got the inflation right at the beginning, and it gets very big very quick, and then it kind of like steadily grows in size until what we call late times, and then it's like flaring out again like in a bell shape, and that is when dark energy is beginning to kick in and it's accelerating again. But the key idea is that Big Bang happens, fraction of a second, massive expansion and inflation, and then a kind of like steady expansion for a few billion years, like 13.7 billion years, and a gradual increase in the rate of acceleration, rate of expansion towards the end. So going back to our timeline, we're still on the 0 to 1 second part of the timeline. In this 0 to 1 second, this is when those four fundamental forces of nature got separated out. So we think that in the beginning they were all like unified, and physicists are like looking for like a unified theory. How do we join together all these theories? How do we join together like the analog watch gravity with the digital watch of quantum field theory? How do we kind of put this together? That's like a holy grail in physics. And we think that in the first fraction of a second, they actually were in some sense unified and then split out later on, all within the first second. And at the same time, in this kind of first second of the universe's existence, quarks were made. There's these little kind of tiny particles inside protons, inside atoms, neutrons, protons, electrons, and positrons, that's like antimatter, were all made. Here is kind of like a graph which shows this. So now we're going down the page. Okay, so time zero is at the top, and it's a log scale graph, which means that it's kind of like distorted. But I've highlighted the key kind of time. So time zero, the Planck time, that tiny time, inflation time, 1 second, and then today. And you can see it's showing how the forces split up. And the easiest thing, like the first thing to think about is, we know two forces of electricity and magnetism. Well, they can be united in a force called electromagnetism. And you can see that as one of the four fundamental forces. And then there's a way of unifying the weak force with the electromagnetic force, and they can kind of come together. And then there's a way of unifying the strong force, and these are what we call grand unified theories in physics. So grand unified theories match up together these three quantum forces. And the kind of thing we're looking to try and do is, how do we unify gravity in all this as well? And we think that in the beginning of time, gravity was kind of unified with those other forces. And people are looking for, can we kind of come up with a quantum theory of gravity? Anyway, this all happened in the first second of the history. And we're kind of like 20 minutes in already. So let's get on with it. So next question, right? What is the universe made of today? And we've got some pie charts to help us out. So the big green and blue pie chart, that tells us that the universe today, it's about 73% dark energy. It's about 23% dark matter. And that remaining kind of 4% is what we call baryonic matter. It means ordinary matter. It means this kind of stuff that we can touch. It means the stars and things that you can see in galaxies, things that shine in the sky. That's all ordinary matter. And the pie chart to the right of that shows, you know, if you break down that, it's got stars make up, you know, some percentage of that, neutrinos, which are kind of another small particle. And then within the kind of like matter that we can see, that's kind of like stuff, 73% is hydrogen, 25% is helium, 1% is oxygen, and 1% is other stuff. Okay, so the fraction of the universe that is kind of things like Earth is very, very, very small indeed. Okay, most of the universe is dark stuff that we can't see. Most of the visible stuff is hydrogen and helium, and not planets and people. So we want to know, how did all this stuff, you know, get to be where it is? And this is a diagram which tells us that over time, beginning at time zero, we went through different phases of the universe's existence. So in the beginning, there was mainly like radiation dominating the universe. Okay, so it was like photons and radiation that were dominating, not matter. Now, the colors correspond to the different kinds of things. Okay, you've got radiation, you've got matter, you've got dark energy, and you can see the three lines on the graph, the red, the blue, and the green. They show how much density there is of those three different things. Now, you can imagine that if the universe begins very small, it's very dense. And like you can imagine that as it gets bigger, okay, it's the same amount of matter, but it's in a larger volume, so the density kind of goes down as it inflates. And that's true for matter, and it's true for radiation. But it's not true for dark energy. This is one of those like mysterious things. The density of matter, okay, gradually decreases as things get like spread out in the universe. And the density of radiation also kind of gets diluted and spreads out. But the dark energy stays constant throughout the whole history of the universe. So in the beginning, radiation dominated. And then as the universe expanded, matter density dominated. And now, in these kind of late times that we're in, the dark energy is what's dominating. Because there's more dark energy than anything else in the universe. Okay, so back to our first second. In our first second, we're in this like primordial soup of like really, really high energy particles, photons all over the place, glue, quarks, and you have this kind of like Clark quark gluon kind of soup. And when they do experiments in the big particle accelerators, like at CERN, like at the Higgs boson, and they're colliding particles, and they're smashing together particles and looking at the debris which is kind of like scattered out afterwards. So you can imagine if you're colliding protons together, you can get quarks coming out of it, and you can kind of study these like high energy particles, similar, okay, not quite such high energy, but a similar kind of idea to what it was like, universe was like at the time of the Big Bang. Okay, lots of very kind of hot charged particles whizzing around in a very, very hot, dense kind of primordial soup. Right, so we've got all these kind of, you know, bits and pieces in the universe, and now we're going to like extend our time some more. Okay, we're going to get to like 60 seconds now. Okay, so a lot can happen in 60 seconds, and in these 60 seconds, we're going to start to get some of the things which are really, really crucial, like helium and hydrogen and deuterium. So yesterday we talked a lot about hydrogen in water, and we talked about heavy water that was made with deuterium. That means it's a hydrogen, it's got a proton, and it's got an additional neutron as well together with it, so it makes it heavy. So in this diagram you can see the red and blue dots, okay, the protons and neutrons. And in terms of physics, okay, a proton is basically a hydrogen atom without an electron, so we think of that as hydrogen. And you can see that they're kind of like having all these reactions and they're sticking together to form deuterium, okay, it's like heavy hydrogen, and helium. And in this first minute, we set the chemical abundances for the next like 10 billion years of the universe's existence. So in this 60 seconds, it controls how much hydrogen and helium there is in the universe going forward. And after the first minute, it's kind of set at hydrogen being around 76%, more or less, and helium being 24%. The hydrogen includes deuterium, okay, the heavy hydrogen as well. And you might think, okay, these are like hydrogen and helium atoms, shouldn't they have electrons? Yes, normally hydrogen and helium have electrons, but in the first minute of the universe's existence, it was so hot and so dense that the atoms couldn't keep a hold of their electrons. Okay, photons kept like whizzing in and hitting the electrons, and the electrons were about to fly off again. So they were all mixed up together, and they just couldn't hold on to their electrons. Okay, so no electrons. It was just kind of like plasma. And you can make plasmas like this in the laboratory. They're basically highly ionized gases. Okay, so in the beginning, we've got this like primordial kind of soup, okay, stuff going on. Things are kind of uniform, okay? It's like, you can imagine like it's a thick kind of soup. It's not really liquid, but you can think of it in that kind of sense. But how do we get from that to things like galaxies and kind of matter spread out all over the place? It turns out the universe, you know, this kind of like plasma, there were oscillations in the universe, and the matter got spread out in different places. Okay, you can imagine like the matter's being spread out, and then gravity is attractive. So if you've got a bit more matter here, that's going to attract other matter towards it, and you're gradually building up a collection of matter here and a collection of matter there. And I have a little animation. This is a different kind of experiment. This experiment is if you put sand on a plate that's like vibrating with a musical note, you will see that you get these kind of like places where the sand all piles up in a particular pattern. And this is sort of what happened in the beginning of the universe, okay? The matter, okay, got kind of piled up, very small, tiny amounts, like less than a grain of sand, you know, more dense and less dense in the early universe. Okay, maybe I'm not going to play this video. But the idea is that the matter gets piled up in particular patterns in the early universe.
32.
Oh, there we go.
32.
So they're playing a musical note, and they're going to start putting sand on, and you'll see that the sand starts moving into the different places in that plate to form a pattern. As if by magic. And something similar happens in the universe. We don't really get these kind of rings in the same way, but the way that matter is distributed works on this kind of idea, okay? That the universe, you know, there's kind of oscillations in the universe and the matter piles up, and then more matter goes to where there's more matter, okay? Matter attracts other matter in it, and it builds up a pattern that we can see in the sky. That's why there isn't like a huge cluster of galaxies there and like empty space for miles and miles and miles there. There's like a uniform pattern about how the galaxies are in the universe. Okay, so fast forward. This axis now has time in billions of years again. Okay, so we're going from 0 years to a billion years. And the important marker here is this thing called recombination that happened 380,000 years after the beginning of the universe. And remember, the little atoms were missing their electrons. Well, now the universe has expanded enough and it's kind of cooled down enough that it can capture a hold of its electrons again. And it's called recombination. When they were never combined in the first place, this is called recombination. And at this moment, all those photons that were knocking into the electrons and getting absorbed by the electrons, now they are free to travel through space, and they do. So 380,000 years after the Big Bang, these light particles, these photons, are released, and they come to us, and we can observe them today. And they're in like the microwave region. Okay, so you can imagine that light has a wavelength, and microwaves have a wavelength. Okay, the wavelength of the photons today that were released by the recombination have the kind of wavelength of microwaves, and we can build telescopes and detect it. And this is a map of the whole kind of like visible sky that we can see, and it's a map of this radiation left over from the Big Bang. And the difference in the spots, they correspond to different temperatures in the sky that vary by like a fraction of a degree. And this is caused by the distribution of matter in the early universe 380,000 years after the Big Bang. Okay, so this is like an indicator showing us how is all that matter, okay, that sand that was like oscillating on the plate, how is all that matter spread out in the early universe? How the matter was spread out in the early universe nearly 13 billion years ago controls directly how the matter in the universe today is distributed. And it's a bit like, okay, here's a map of England. The left-hand map is England in the 1700s, and the right-hand map is England after the Industrial Revolution. And the colors show the population density. And you can see that in the 1700s, you can see like London's kind of down in the south and like a dark orange bit, and people are like spread out through the whole country. But you can see that after the Industrial Revolution, people are like clustering in the cities. They're like going to the cities, to London, so it's getting kind of like pinker and darker, and there's more people. And so the idea is that in that 200-year span, what set the location of the people 200 years later was kind of like planted seeds 200 years earlier. So where the city began, more people moved to the city. And it's the same with the universe, right? It's the same with how the structure, okay, of the universe grows. So at time zero, okay, by the way, the map of England is not to scale on this diagram, time-wise. just saying. But the other thing is, okay, so what is happening is the distribution of matter in the early universe 13 billion years ago, okay, 380,000 years after the beginning of the universe, that sets the locations of the galaxies and stuff today, right? Because like all the matter moved into the cities where the matter was originally. Okay, so the kind of structure of the universe grew in that way. The seeds of the order of the universe were planted 13 billion years ago. And that's how it grows. And I'm talking about galaxies in this picture, but actually there's a kind of like underneath part of the universe that you can't see, which is dark matter. And dark matter is distributed over the whole universe in a particular pattern. Okay, so this is showing how dark matter is distributed in part of the universe. And this is like a small section, like look at the sky up there. And this pattern gets repeated all over the whole universe. This is only dark matter. This is showing how dark matter is distributed in the universe. So the brighter it is, the more dark matter there is. The darker it is, the less dark matter there is. And you can think of it like an iceberg. Okay, an iceberg is a bit more familiar than dark matter. And you know that when you see an iceberg, you see the top of it, and most of it you can't see because it's under the water. That's the same with matter in the universe. Okay, so we can see stuff like galaxies, but underneath the galaxies is this whole kind of structure of dark matter that we can't see with our eyes, but we know it's there because we can measure it. So when we look at the universe with our eyes, we see all the galaxies kind of spread out, and the points of light here are the galaxies that we can see with our eyes. But you can see there's these kind of like contours underneath. Those contours, they are showing the locations of the dark matter. Okay, so the dark matter is like the underneath part of the iceberg, and it's controlling where the galaxies and things are in the universe. The distribution of the dark matter and the distribution of the galaxies is all governed by the distribution of that matter from the radiation I showed you at recombination. That's what the structure comes from today. Okay, so now we can kind of skip ahead and like bigger jumps of time, you'd be relieved to know. And we could start talking about the formation of the first stars, which were somewhere between 200 million and 400 million years after the beginning of the universe. And these stars were different from the stars that we have today. Right, so they were formed in the early universe, and in the beginning, like we call them population 3 stars, and in the beginning we thought, oh, well, they've all like died out long ago. But actually they have found some of these what we call very, very early stars. This is one of the telescopes that took a picture of one of those stars, and you can't see it, but it's in the little box. Okay, it's too faint for us to see, but it's in the little box on that patch of sky. So these stars began 200 to 400 million years after the beginning of the universe. And just after that were the formation of the first galaxies. Okay, I mentioned these two things together because they kind of like come together. So first of all, how the universe got its galaxies. You can imagine that we're talking about this matter clumping together. Now, the matter, there's dark matter, and then there's all these like clouds of hydrogen that have captured their little electrons, so they're like neutral hydrogen now. And gradually, the clouds of hydrogen fall together, and matter attracts more matter. Okay, success breeds success. So it kind of like pulls together all the hydrogen towards itself, and gradually it forms like big lumps of stuff, which eventually we call galaxies. And the galaxies form, and the galaxies kind of cluster together as well. And then we have this kind of like time of, I think I'm missing a slide, but don't worry. Then we have this kind of time between 200 to 400 million years forward to the evolution of, you know, the Sun and the Earth as we know it today. And I just want to kind of like fill in some of this blue gap, this blue arrow here, and talk about galaxies. Now, this diagram goes the opposite direction time-wise to ours, because that's how the picture was made. So you can see on the right-hand side, that's, you know, the Big Bang time, and the left-hand side is today. So the galaxies on the far right, they were 2 billion years after the beginning of the universe. And you can see they don't have like such a good structure. They're like kind of like cloudy-like, you know, kind of like a bit kind of like randomy. And then 5 billion years, 9 billion years, 14 billion years, they're starting to get more well-defined to look like galaxies, how we think about galaxies today. Okay, so in this time, right, basically that's what's happening. The galaxies were evolving to form galaxies like the galaxies that we see today. And at the same time, the stars were also evolving forward. Now, back to this question about the stars. Okay, those stars that I showed you in the beginning, those kind of early stars, at that time, 200 to 400 billion years, you know, after the beginning of the universe, all that we had in the universe was basically hydrogen, helium, heavy hydrogen, loads of dark matter and stuff, but that wasn't really useful for making stars, and a few trace amounts of things like lithium and beryllium. So the first stars that were made, they only really contained hydrogen and helium and trace amounts of other very, very, very light elements. And the question is, well, okay, that's great, but how do we get things like carbon, oxygen, nitrogen that we kind of see in Earth? And how do we get the Sun? Because the Sun that we have also contains other things as well as hydrogen and helium. And the answer is nuclear physics. Okay, so there's a kind of process you can go through, and basically things can stick together and fuse together. So the very top diagram, you can see it's helium atoms are like joining together to form carbon, And then underneath that, this kind of like cycle, this is a carbon cycle. It's telling you how different atoms of carbon can join together to form things like nitrogen and oxygen. This is all what we call nuclear fusion, and it's about what's happening in the center of an atom. So we were talking yesterday about, you know, atoms joining together through like bonds between electrons. This is about changing the number of neutrons and protons in the center of the atom to get new chemical elements. You need a lot of energy to do this, okay? This is not kind of trivial to do this. So in fact, what you've actually got to do is, you know, have a big like nuclear fusion reactor. Luckily, we have that in the universe. So here we are. This is a diagram showing the evolution of stars. Okay, so basically, as a star begins to run out of hydrogen, which is its main nuclear fuel, it starts collapsing. And because it's collapsing, it gets like even hotter and denser. So it means it can begin fusing helium into higher elements. And then it burns through all the helium, runs out of helium, and collapses again. And then it starts fusing helium into things like carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen. Right, so that was the kind of process we showed on the previous slide. So things like, you know, like all the kind of like carbon in your bodies was formed in a nuclear reaction in a star somewhere. That's how it kind of came to be. Now, you might think this is a great process, we can just like keep going with it and we can make kind of other stuff. But it turns out that when you get to iron, you kind of start taking in energy. Right? So this process of nuclear fusion and in kind of normal burning in stars doesn't work. So the stars collapse in a violent and dramatic thermonuclear explosion called a supernova. And this is showing that the different kind of options that can happen. You know, you can get like supernova, and you can get supernova with a black hole, supernova with a white dwarf, just like a cold death. But these are all different nuclear reactions that take place in the life cycle of a star. And it's in these very, very dramatic nuclear explosions, these supernova explosions, that heavy metals like gold and magnesium and silver are formed. So if you're wearing like a wedding ring that's got gold or silver in it, or you've got a cross, all that kind of metal was formed in these nuclear reactions in the heart of exploded stars. And that's the only way to make this kind of stuff. So this is how the universe got its gold and heavy metals. So we're now gradually like gathering together all the ingredients that we need to eventually make things like Earth and people. So, stars. So we talked about those kind of early stars that were all just like hydrogen and helium. And now we're going to talk about stars like our Sun, okay, which have other things as well as hydrogen and helium in them. And stars are born in these kind of like clouds of gas and dust. So you can imagine like the universe is like full of debris, okay, like of exploded stars, and it's deep in these like dust pockets that stars begin. And this is just like zooming in. Okay, you can use like an infrared camera and you can see through the dust clouds to where new stars are being born, and they're being born and formed in the center of these dust clouds. And this is like metal-rich stars like our Sun were formed in this way. And our Sun began about 4.6 billion years ago. And this slide is showing the birth of the Sun, and then it's going to like evolve forwards in time. So our Sun is basically middle-aged. Okay, it's kind of like halfway through its life cycle. It's been around about 4.6 billion years, and it's going to be around for another, you know, 5 billion years or so. Just for completeness, to show you like the full time cycle of the Sun, we're not going to go past, of course, the creation of Earth. But just if, in case you're interested in the future, the Sun will eventually explode into a red giant, engulf the Earth, vaporize the oceans, probably hit Jupiter, and then die as a white dwarf. So, but that's a long time in the future. So at the same time, right, deep in these like kind of pockets of gas and dust, when the Sun is being formed and the stars are being formed, Karine mentioned yesterday about how we have big disks of gas and dust that are rotating, and she told us all about how planets get formed in this place. So this diagram is kind of like a recap of yesterday's slide, and you can see that we have like a big cloud and it kind of collapses, and then we get a spinning disk of dust and gas, and in the middle, okay, that's when the star forms. The star is like all the kind of hydrogen and helium coalescing together, and eventually it's hot enough and dense enough to start nuclear fusion, and start having new sun shining. And then in the kind of like dust cloud around that star, the rotating dust cloud, that's where planets are formed. And this is all pretty new stuff in like the past kind of, 15, 20 years, because we didn't really know how planets were formed. But recently, we've started to be able to take photographs of these kind of things, like we know they exist, and we can see planets forming in this way. These are radio photographs taken by the Atacama Large Millimeter Array, which is a big radio telescope in the Atacama Desert in Chile. And it's taking photographs of those clouds of gas and dust around these like baby stars that are being born. So what you're looking at here is a radio image of those dust clouds. And it's pretty impressive, right? And then if you talk to like a planetary scientist, they could tell you about snow lines and all these important things that I'm not such an expert in. But the idea is that this is how planets are formed, and this is where they are formed. And the one on the very far right, that's actually two kind of stars close together that have planetary systems going around it. And this is pretty much, you know, how the Earth was born. Okay, the Earth was born out of this kind of coalescing of matter, of material, that was around our baby star, the Sun. So the Earth and the Sun were kind of formed around about the same time, after about 9.5 billion years of the universe, okay, like 4.6 billion years ago. So we've just come from like time zero through to the creation of Earth, okay, like this span of 9.5 billion years. We're 4.6 billion years further ahead of that, and I'm going to stop right here at the creation of Earth.
Great job of condensing 9.5 billion years into a somewhat reasonable time scale. So,
thank you.
So I'm sure there are probably some questions. So, starting back here.
I'm just curious about plant time. So if you think there's like beginning and then there's probably very, very small plant time, and then we'll say physics starts maybe a little bit, say. But if we're using physics post plant time to do all the research back, how can we measure like plant time lasting this long using stuff that only came around after plant time?
Yeah, so the Planck time, okay, it comes from a definition of the fundamental constants that we use in quantum field theory and gravitation. And it's connected with things like the radius of primordial black holes and Compton scattering and stuff. So it's basically like a fundamental limit that we know that quantum theory breaks down on those limits. A bit like you know how like Newtonian physics works great here, but as you start approaching the speed of light, Newtonian physics breaks down. There's a similar limit with quantum field theory, okay? And that limit is this kind of very small distance that we call the Planck time. So we just know, like, we know what happens after that. We don't know what happens before that because it's kind of like beyond our reach.
What's the current thinking about what the universe is expanding into?
The current thinking is that the universe, as the universe expands, it creates space and time. There's no such thing as like outside the universe. Yeah, I know, that's like, ask the philosophers. There's no such thing. Like, there is the universe, space and time.
Is there a conversation about whether the universe, so the visible universe is what we're able to see?
Yes.
Is there a conversation about, Could what's on there, do we have any guess on whether that's finite or infinite, or like how do scientists think about these sorts of things?
Yes. So physics deals with the visible, the physical, the observable. So anything that's not physical, visible, or observable is not part of physics. Okay, so basically there's a horizon, okay, and we can't see beyond the horizon. Just like here, we can't see beyond the horizon on Earth. There's a horizon which is 13.7 billion light years away because light from beyond that hasn't had time to reach us yet. But as time goes by, right, we can see further and further into the universe as time goes by. So the universe definitely exists beyond the visible horizon. So like the visible horizon is just like we can't see beyond it. Another question is things like, does the universe have an edge? Is it finite? Is it infinite? And depending on how you define this, it's interesting, right? For example, the Earth, contrary to popular belief, does not have an edge. You can't fall off it. Right? So the Earth is like a closed surface. And it might be that the universe is a closed surface in a fourth dimension, right? Because... Enough? Okay, so time has a direction, right? So you can definitely kind of put time forward. And then if you rewind time, you're going to get to a point where time begins. Like, time is a physical thing that exists. Time doesn't exist by itself. It's one of the dimensions of the universe. And the universe, I don't know, like, in the 1920s, they believed in an eternal universe. They thought the universe is eternal, and it's like a steady-state universe, and it's existed forever. But that's not the picture that we have today. Now we have this kind of picture that the universe, because we see it expanding today, we like rewind the clock and say that it must have been all kind of like compressed into a particular point in the past, which is time zero.
You've given a kind of brief history of the universe.
Yeah.
And some scientists have in mind Neil deGrasse Tyson, others who write what they call big history, give this sort of history of the universe, and then offer it as a kind of alternative creation narrative, sometimes very explicitly against a kind of Christian narrative that in Genesis and so forth. And argue for the superiority of this narrative because it's scientific. And I wonder what you would say about that.
Sure, yeah. So you have to think about why was Genesis written, who wrote it, and why, what was the purpose of Genesis? Okay, Genesis, like, I don't know, a few thousand years ago, they were writing Genesis. They were, you know, Moses or whoever wrote Genesis, they were inspired by God to convey a message, right? Which is stuff like, God is good, God made the universe, God loves you, you're made in God's image and likeness. The sun and moon and stars are not gods, don't worship them. Okay, so that was like the kind of basic message that they were trying to get across. At the time, people of that time, like the Babylonians and the Egyptians and everybody else, they had a different scientific worldview. Okay, their worldview was like, the earth is kind of flat, and there's a dome across the sky, and the dome divides the waters above the heavens from the waters below the heavens, and you can open little trapdoors in the sky, and the rain comes through, and the stars move across the dome. And like the Egyptians would say, okay, and every morning the goddess Shea gives birth to the sun, and the god Re carries it across the sky, and at nighttime she swallows it again and gives birth to it in the morning. So all these different cultures of the time had the same physical worldview, which is like flat earth, sky dome, waters above, waters below, but they had different religious interpretations. Okay, so if you read something like the Enuma Elish, she'll talk about fights in heavens and gods being kind of broken into bits and the earth being made of dead gods and all that kind of stuff. So when the author of Genesis, when the human kind of like author, okay, who was doing the writing, was writing Genesis, they were writing using the scientific kind of knowledge of their day, which was accepted by all those kind of cultures. What they were changing was the religious narrative. They were saying, hey, look, the sun and moon and the stars are not gods. They're not even going to have names. Like, don't worship them. They're created by God. The universe is not made of the bodies of dead monsters. The universe is good. Humans are good. So basically, Genesis had the scientific narrative that was appropriate for its day, and it had, on top of that, a religious narrative. And today, we have a different scientific narrative, but we have the same religious narrative. Okay, the same thing. It's like, God made the universe is good, don't worship the sun, don't worship the stars. And we have a scientific narrative that's shared with, you know, cultures around the world.
Back. in the beginning, Father Brent talked to us about an elemental view of the universe versus the principal view of the universe. This would seem to be an elemental view of the universe and not a principal view of the universe. What would you say to a more principal view of the universe, the way Father Brent talked to us about it in the first lecture?
Yeah, so I'm really sorry, but I wasn't here for Father Brent's lecture, so I'm not able to comment on that at all.
Yeah. Well, we can maybe bring it up. We can talk about it a little later.
Yeah. Ask one of the philosophy experts.
Thank you very much. So it seems like the model you're giving here of the history of the universe, right? You, of course, have the Big Bang, I guess it was the very beginning, right? And then this rapid state of expansion, right? But then sort of the expansion slows down, right? And then it speeds up, is that right?
That's exactly right.
Okay, so my question then, okay, is on Newtonian physics here, right? The only way these things can slow down is some sort of outside force slowing them down. Right? So if you have so to speak two bullets I think in the air, right? Traveling next to each other, it's not like the slowing, it's something outside of it that's slowing it down. So how can the rate of expansion slow down temporarily if there's nothing outside of the universe in the traditional sense of the term universe never do that?
Or any sense. Right? Yeah. Okay, so good question. So, and you can imagine like a Newtonian view of the universe as well and still get this right. So imagine you've got something like, the classic example is like a loaf of bread. Okay, you're going to bake some bread and you mix in like the flour and the yeast and everything and you put currants in the bread and then you leave it to rise. Okay, and the dough kind of rises and as it rises, the currents, okay, get kind of separated out and that's kind of like a model of the expansion of the universe. And we can have like a Newtonian model that explains like it's kind of ball of dust kind of expanding, dust and gas. What causes that initial kind of expansion? Okay, it's not yeast. There's a big bang, okay, which gives it like the momentum. It's like if I roll a ball down the hallway towards you, the ball is going to keep rolling towards you, right? I've only given it a force at the beginning, but then it keeps on rolling until it, I don't know, until it runs out of energy or something. Because it loses energy through friction. So the initial thing which makes the universe expand was the Big Bang. Okay, so that was like the initial kind of like push. And then without adding any additional forces, the universe continues to expand. Except it's full of massive heavy stuff. Now massive heavy stuff, like matter, okay, it's gravitationally attractive. So it pulls things together again. So we would naturally expect that if you have this kind of like big kind of loaf of bread expanding, or this like, you know, imagine those kind of pictures you saw of the like nuclear explosions where there's a kind of a mushroom cloud goes up. Yes, the cloud expands, but eventually it's going to like collapse and fall in on itself again. That was the view of the universe that we had until 1998. Right, until 1998 we're like debating, is the universe going to like keep expanding at a constant rate, or is there a force in the universe that's going to like pull it together again? And that force exists, okay? That force is called gravity, and it's caused by the presence of matter. So you don't need something outside the universe. It's a bit like if you pull an elastic band apart, you don't need something outside to push it together again. Okay, it's going to pull itself together. And gravity is like that. It's going to pull together all the stuff in the universe. What they discovered in 1998 was, hey, guess what? The universe is actually getting bigger faster. So there must be like an additional push, pushing it out, like a force that's still acting. And that's where dark energy comes in.
So theoretically, the Big Bang model, it seems like all that exists in the universe almost should exist like on the shell of the expansion, almost like people are believing. And the balloon itself is going to be on the outside because everything is expanding forward from that initial moment. Does that make sense?
That's what people think.
Right. So
and it kind of makes sense, but
there's stuff not just on the shell of the universe. But
yeah. So what you have to imagine, like you have to think about thinking in higher dimensions. Okay. So if you are talking about your balloon example, okay, so everyone's thinking about a balloon with kind of like dots on the balloon, and as the balloon is inflated, the space between the dots gets further apart. That is a model of a two-dimensional universe immersed in the third dimension of space, okay, because it's being curved in the third dimension. So, like, if you lived in that model universe, you could only live on the surface of the balloon, right? You couldn't, like, jump up or jump down. So for you, like, where is the center of Earth's surface? Exactly, right, exactly. So it's the same with, like, the universe and the expansion, okay? There isn't like, a center from which the universe is expanding from. So when you're thinking about your example of a balloon, you have to imagine that we live, like, it's a totally valid example, right? But think about the surface, right? So because we're a universe that is a three-dimensional universe, and when gravity curves space-time fabric, it's curving it in the fourth space dimension, right? So you can imagine it with, like, a three-dimensional universe immersed in a fourth dimension. So that's how you need to translate your balloon example. So that there isn't a center from which the universe is expanding, and there isn't, like, a kind of outer shell in that sense.
Seems like there should be
no. I know, people like to think that, but so, physics says otherwise.